Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures into everyday terms for regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And in this episode, we give a retrospective look at the historic criminal sentencing of President Donald Trump. We talk about the reasoning used by New York Judge Juan Merchan, the proceeding itself, and the Supreme Court decision leading up to the sentencing. Well, it's been, Judge Gail, it's been a monumental time in criminal law. And you have been saying throughout this proceeding in New York that even though there were 34 guilty verdicts by a jury way back in the summer, that Trump was not a convicted felon until his sentencing. That's happened. Now we can say the word convicted felon, correct?
In my view, yes, we can. Now, as you know, and I think we agree that there are some who certainly embrace a different school of thought and kind of gratuitously, in my view, kind of use that term conviction or convicted after the jury has delivered a verdict. But you and I both know there are all kinds of legal mechanisms that are still available to set aside jury verdicts and to undo them. So that's why I'm always cautious about whether or not we fully embrace that term, because if you'll remember, in this case, there was quite a bit of motion practice, meaning attorneys filing motions with the court to undo the jury's verdict, which could have really changed the terminology. Right?
Motions for a new trial, motion for jury misconduct.
Motion to set aside the verdict.
Based on immunity, the presidential immunity decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, all
absolutely.
Of those.
Absolutely. And those, you know, judgments notwithstanding the verdicts or JNOVs that are designed to essentially tell a judge that the jury lost their way during deliberations and the decision that they made was incorrect and that the court should correct it by, you know, throwing it out, disregarding it, substituting it.
I have never, ever issued a judgment notwithstanding the verdict. Have you?
Nor have I. And I will tell you, even when I felt as a litigator, even when I felt like I had the strongest case imaginable, I've also never asked for one.
I've asked for one just to cover my butt sometimes, you know, to make sure that you dotted every I before appeal. But I never expected to win one as a defense attorney. And as a judge, I'd never granted one. You know, it's got to be horrible for a horrible miscarriage of justice for a judge to step in and say, oh, jury, you've heard this case for a month now, and you made your collective decision, all 12 of you, and you're wrong.
Consider the idea that what you're suggesting is all of you lost your way. Like everybody realizing, yes, in a criminal case, you're required to return a unanimous verdict, but it kind of suggests that no one in the whole group kind of had the presence of mind to say, hey, this is off the rails. I'm going to be the holdout to cause a mistrial, as opposed to saying, no, every single one of you lost your way. And therefore, this unanimous verdict that all of you have agreed upon cannot be relied upon and therefore must be substituted for the wisdom of the court. That, and I also think it kind of speaks perhaps even to a failing of the court, because the jury is guided by the instructions that the court provides them with, not the instructions from the prosecution or the defense, although they may have had input, but they are given those instructions of law from the court, and to suggest that the court did, I don't know, such a substandard job in providing instruction and guidance that at the end of the day, it had to throw it all out and completely substitute its own judgment for that of the jury, doesn't speak well for the process at all, but also it doesn't say a whole lot for the jurist.
So in short, those were just really stretches. Those were motions to file to delay things. So let's step back a little bit.
I'll tell you, some of that was just an exercise to see how much ink the printer holds.
Well, yeah, and also it was theatrics and it was political and all kinds of things in this kind of case that aren't present in the normal criminal case.
Well, in a normal sense that if your client doesn't have a lot of money, right? Because also consider the fact that if you are, you know, a wealthy defendant and you've got vast resources, then you can instruct your attorneys to file motions till the cows come home, because the cost benefit leans greater toward you. If you're someone with limited resources and it perhaps is less cost efficient to do that, then no, you're not going to see this kind of aggressive motion practice.
When I was doing criminal defense work, some of my clients had to scrape together money to actually pay me, but they also then had unreasonable expectations. I remember right after the O.J. Simpson case where they used computer animation to trace steps and pieces of evidence and so forth.
Maybe the first of its kind.
I had a client who came in and in all seriousness, this client said, "I want one of those. I want one of those in my case."
And it probably with a piggy bank in tow. So let's count out.
And I said, "You know, that would cost you probably a six-figure amount."
I doubt you have that stored up in the piggy bank here.
Yeah, I thought I picked the guy up off the floor, but you know, people do have sometimes unreasonable expectations.
And aren't these some of the same ones we deal with when people look at television and they see a case crime that's committed, investigated, you know, solved, presumably charged, tried, and convicted in 60 minutes plus commercials?
Yeah. Well, you did that. You did some TV work where you did a case in, 20 minutes?
Indeed, yes, in 20 minutes.
now,
and you're right. And mind you, sometimes I even had the help of the voting audience. So that was unique thing, because we kind of used America as the audience to vote the verdict in many of those instances. And notwithstanding how shocking it was to me, because I sometimes would wonder, like, exactly what crack recipe are we relying on? This is a new and improved crack recipe. But you know, you still, even in those instances, right, I could have set aside the verdict of America and instead decided to adopt it, because I just genuinely believe in this process. I believe that we arm people with information, we explain things to them, we guide them through it, and then we trust them when it is said and done.
Well, Judge Juan Merchan, the judge in the New York case, did trust the jury and also trusted his legal wisdom to say that the presidential immunity case did not really apply to this New York state case. And if parts of it did, then as we've talked in the past, it was harmless error. And he was going to go ahead with sentencing. So he set sentencing for January 10th. Did a very, very smart thing in setting the sentencing. He also said, "I'm setting the sentencing. The defendant can appear in person or virtually. And I'm not going to impose any fine or jail time. I'm going to use something that's called an unconditional discharge." Mm-hmm. He said all that in setting the date. But did that stop the Trump defense team from going forward to try to stall this or eliminate it? No, it did not.
I mean, just so, won't take yes for an answer. That's what I saw, is that you won't take yes for an answer because you got everything essentially you asked for. If I'm correct, the unconditional discharge is also what his attorneys asked for.
And the prosecution didn't object to it.
But
anyway, there was still the idea, as we started this discussion, of the conviction, you know, and the conviction being solid once the sentence was put into place. Mm-hmm. So the Trump people got busy and filed motions to delay this and took the case to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court really was confronted with this issue, as I understand it, and I'd like to get your opinion on this. The issue before the court was to stay the sentencing indefinitely because the presidential immunity that they put down in for official acts that they put down in their July 1 decision, the Trump people argued that that applied to a president-elect, not just the president. So that was the main thrust of the argument to the court, that trying to get the court to extend their presidential immunity into that president-elect status.
To the now, president part of in that, waiting.
Yeah, part of that was to delay the sentencing, but I think part of that was to give Trump more power before the inauguration. What do you think?
I agree with those two posits that, A, I think just about everything that's been done from the defense side here has some intention of delaying the outcome. And so, and I quite honestly believe that that is perhaps one of the more pressing things that they were focused on. Rarely did I see real substantive arguments as much as they were strategic. And the strategy is, you know, again, how far down the road can you kick this can? They had been successful many times before, and this is the time when they needed perhaps the most success. So I certainly agree with regard to the point of delaying, because if they could delay the sentencing, they could, you know, potentially never have the sentencing or seriously, you know, delay it past at least 4 years. To your second point, however, about conferring additional authority onto the president-elect pre-inauguration, I don't disagree with that. I certainly believe that actually from election night forward that the president-elect believed he was just the president, that there's really no such status as president-elect for him.
But we can't have two presidents.
Absolutely. But I don't know if you're aware, but I've rarely seen logic get in the way of his actions and reasoning and precedent. I don't know that there's evidence that has been sufficient to change his thinking or even, you know, the way that he acts or carries himself. So with that said, I genuinely believe that, yes, you have attorneys that are essentially mimicking what is the deeply, closely held, genuine beliefs of an individual who holds an elect status, which is quite interesting because, as you just said, we recognize one president at a time. For us to be living at a time that is so unprecedented that we have a now president-elect that, quite frankly, if we're just going to be really honest about it, there was really some question as to whether or not he would survive the election cycle given the assassination attempts. And if that's taken into consideration, then there is certainly no guarantee that he would make it to the actual inauguration. And that actually, I think, butts up against that idea that there's more than one president at a time, or that the president-elect is conferred with the same authority as the sitting president. Because again, there's no guarantee, especially in this climate, that any such president-elect will actually be inaugurated, which is why the power only transfers in that moment. But again, that's logic. That's reason, which is something that has been forcefully rebutted and pushed against by the incoming administration. But I absolutely agree. But I also think the other thing is something that goes back to probably when both of us were in our early, you know, days of you know,
judging
a literature school or literature class. And it's a thing called the Scarlet Letter. And I think the goal here, you know, for as much gravitas as the president-elect portrays, there is something to be said about carrying the scarlet letter of a felon and being labeled as such.
The first convicted felon ever to be president.
And hopefully only, because it is amazingly embarrassing. But also consider this idea. This is also an individual who is now the face and head of a party who, as a convicted felon himself, this party has at least demonstrated historically, I mean, absolute endless efforts to limit the voting access of convicted felons. So it's amazing how they worked so hard to limit the rights of convicted felons. And yet this is who will be inaugurated.
Well, the Supreme Court heard all of those arguments, and by a 5-4 decision, said that the sentencing could go forward. Now, we've talked about this.
Were you surprised by that?
Somewhat, yeah. There was normally, we would expect a 6-3 decision with the six Republican appointees to the court, and some clearly more MAGA than others. And there was a 6-3 decision on the presidential immunity case back in July, which prompted so much of all of this. But this was a 5-4 decision, which means two of the justices flipped and went to the liberal side of the court. And those two justices were Amy Coney Barrett and Chief Justice Roberts. Those two sided with the liberal wing of the court to say, yeah, go ahead with the sentencing. It doesn't interfere with the any kind of duties. There are no official duties of the president-elect. So it doesn't interfere with those duties. There isn't going to be much of a sentence anyway. It's not going to take that much time. Go forward with it. Were you surprised with the 5-4?
Oh, I absolutely was. That's why I asked you if you were surprised with that.
Yeah.
That breakdown. And I wondered, and I actually invite your input on this. I wondered if part of the reason for this 5-4 decision, which is considered extremely close, separated by just one vote, if part of it is because some of the justices who voted in that 6-3 immunity decision are now seeing and or realizing the worst of their beliefs of what could have happened as a result of that decision, meaning how that immunity decision has become kind of the bully pulpit, if you will, for someone, or how it's become the almost exclusive tool that has been leaned upon to escape any form of accountability, and that perhaps not every justice that voted in that 6-3 decision was expecting that this would be the outcome, the fallout, the result of that. And so I was absolutely surprised, because I've kind of come to, I don't know, I suppose this belief that everything, just about everything, is going to be 6-3. It's going to be 6-3. And if there's an appointment of a new justice, then it's going to swing even further. The pendulum's going to swing even further for at least another generation. That said, I wondered if there was some buyer's remorse, if you will. No pun intended on my last name, but buyer's remorse on that decision. What do you think?
My opinion on that is that Amy Coney Barrett probably had some buyer's remorse. She was a bit on the fence with the presidential immunity case. I don't think that she was really happy with the way the decision came down. And the chief, I think this was a bridge too far for him. He already had extended presidential immunity beyond anything historical in our country's history. And to then extend that to a president-elect, I think just was a bridge too far for him. Mm-hmm. Plus, this came on the heels of him issuing the annual report of the court, where he was expressed dismay that the public was uneasy about that decision, and expressed, you know, why doesn't the public trust us in this? And it was really a lament. I've had experience with those annual reports, and they're usually just cut and dried. This was a lament. Why don't you like us?
Kind of, Book of Lamentations.
Kind of report. And so I just think he thought, well, if we go and prevent the sentencing, this is just going to be a bridge too far, and we may burn the whole place down, so to speak. So,
well, I'd also like to introduce that doctrine of, you know, things just being a little premature. The fact of the matter is as you said about Judge Mershon, he was very, and he has been throughout this case, very thoughtful and, quite frankly, very masterful. Obviously, you know, expressing more insight into, you know, the possibility of what could happen than even, you know, Chief Justice Roberts, who is, you know, apparently wondering why he's sitting alone at the, you know, middle school lunchroom table. Now that he's, you know, stolen everybody's, you know, ball lunch and money. Lunch. Right. And I'm like, hey, dude, you didn't see this coming? You didn't understand that the public relying on you to be, you know, thoughtful, smart, objective, neutral, sees you as nothing more of a tool now, and that these things will have effect and impact? Absolutely. And when you embolden someone who's already demonstrated no respect for the judicial system, for judges, or for the judiciary, except when it works in their favor, how do you think the average John Q. public is going to respond to that? So Judge Mershon doesn't have to be a swami to have known
and he was so artful by tipping off the Supreme Court, knowing that it would go to the Supreme Court, saying, hey, yes. Look, I'm not gonna make him do anything. I'm not gonna put him in jail. I'm not gonna fine him.
He didn't even impose a fine. That's what I was gonna say. He didn't even get a fine.
I'm not doing anything to this guy. And so the Supreme Court, that was a tip off to the Supreme Court to go, oh, well, then sentencing might not be so bad.
Right. And so for our listeners, what often happens and what is necessary for an appellate court to consider when things like this happen kind of midstream, this is still considered midstream because the case wasn't fully over,
right,
is whether or not the issue is what's called ripe or prepared or ready for the court to decide. And I think a great argument, aside from the fact that he wasn't facing any meaningful penalties or sanctions is the fact that it just wasn't ripe for the Supreme Court or any appellate court to interject. You know, first, because you're right, again, Judge, that there is only one president at a time. So the status of president-elect is virtually meaningless until you are inaugurated, because you have no official duties and you can engage in no official duties until such time. And so for the court, for the lower court, meaning the court in New York, to even signal what it was preparing to do and how it was preparing to resolve this matter, until they did that, there would have been nothing for the Supreme Court to really substantively decide. They couldn't decide that Judge Marchand had not taken enough of the facts and circumstances into consideration, that Judge Marchand was, you know, sentencing the defendant outside kind of the outliers of similarly situated.
But he wanted to make him feel better. So he just said, look, I'm not doing anything to the guy.
Exactly. And he's saying, and he's literally telegraphing this for an audience of nine, not even the audience of one, but the audience of nine, to say, hey, hey, take a look. I've already pretty much outlined what the sentence is going to be. And so even if the case were ripe, even if it were ready or prepared for you to review my ruling, you're going to be, this is what you're going to be reviewing. Absolutely right. Nothing. Goose egg.
Well, there was a side issue at the Supreme Court level, and then we'll get back to the trial court level. But there was a side issue at the Supreme Court level. And that was the day before the arguments went down. Justice Alito had a private telephone call with President-elect Donald Trump. And the media got wind of this, and it was framed that Justice Alito was talking to the president on behalf of one of his former law clerks who was up for a potential job in Trump's administration, and that they didn't talk about this case. In fact, he didn't even know that there was a motion coming to the court. Alito also said, we didn't talk about any other cases. Yeah, right.
Is this the same guy who doesn't know that his wife puts a flag up and lacks the chutzpah to tell her to take it down when he does?
Or goes out and takes it down himself.
I'm just wondering if this is the same guy.
That's the same guy. Okay. Same guy. So, you know, that sent terrors through people when they saw that prior to the decision coming out, going, okay, here's another ethical matter before the court. And clearly, Justice Alito was one of the four who voted against the sentencing. It was Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Thomas.
Thomas. No surprise there.
No surprise there. The gruesome foursome.
Who have clearly joined the circus by twisting themselves into pretzels to justify this.
But yeah, so that was a side issue that came out. And of course, people were calling for recusal, or Alito to remute. Recusal is when the judge removes himself or herself from a particular case for a potential conflict. There was no recusal, and so that raises the ethical issue still hanging over the Supreme Court, that cloud, and that's for another program. But I would have been remiss if we hadn't mentioned that side issue.
And I'm glad that you mentioned that side issue, because it winds back to something that you noted earlier about Chief Justice Roberts' annual report and the state of the court, because this underscores, Chief, I hope you listen to Next Witness, please. Please, we just want to provide you some free advice. These are examples of why there is decreased faith in the justice system, starting with your court. You are the face of the highest court in the land. And it appears that you have absolutely not even control, that the justices, the associate justices, lack even the respect of the court and the people to conduct themselves in a way that does not further tarnish the image of the court. There is no reason in the world, unless Justice Alito is suffering from diminished mental capacity, there's no reason in the world why he could not have had a conversation with himself and said, is this the right time to make this call? I mean,
he received the call from the president. He received
the call. Is this the right time to take this call?
Exactly.
Is this the right time? Should I even take this call, all things considered, or should I just wait? Is there really imminency to this? Like, is this something that has to happen right now?
And how many times does a president-elect vet personally?
Right.
Members of his administration.
Given the vastness of his administration, you mean to tell me Steve Bannon wasn't available that day to start vetting people? Elon Musk seems to be hanging around just gratuitously. I'm sure you can give him a task or two to vet some stuff. I am confident that we are not talking about chief counsel to the White House. And even if we were, didn't you appoint a chief of staff already? Are you telling me that these folks cannot be trusted to begin a vetting process and you had to do it personally? And it just so happens that this call has to come the day before the court hears and decides on arguments as to whether or not to proceed with sentencing in your criminal cases. Like, I just want to, if we don't assign this mental acuity to President-elect Trump, I've got to say, there's got to be a reason why we've got 9 justices there. We got to believe that they're smart enough to have navigated this. And this seems like either, again, demonstrative mental of failing in mental capacity. He's got to be suffering with dementia or something, or you just don't care how it looks. And if you don't care how it looks, then here, back to you, Chief Justice Roberts.
Yeah, that's when it falls on you. Alito doesn't care, and Chief Roberts is going, but it's my court, and it's my legacy, and people don't like us, and geez.
I am amazed that he's
take some control, Chief. Some control.
If I can just be brazen and say, Chief, find some balls. This has been really an embarrassment of you.
Really,
and we've
has.
Been telegraphing this for a while. We've been saying you've lacked a backbone
in
for
all kinds
a while.
Of cases.
In all kinds of cases, in instances that are so simple and so easy. It is not hard to enforce an ethics policy amongst the justices. It is not hard to impose a policy of recusal. The same one that every other judge, every place else in any town USA is required to utilize when there is the appearance of impropriety.
And all federal judges,
yes!
All federal judges are governed by ethics that are enforceable through the Judicial Conference of the United States. They have a committee that looks at potential ethical violations or supposed ethical violations and makes determinations.
And so you can't imagine. I'm so bothered by the idea that Chief Justice Roberts believed that this nose thumbing that they've been doing to the rest of the public should have no impact. What do you mean they don't like us? What do you mean they don't trust us? What do you mean they don't believe us? Well, exactly that.
Yeah. Get out of the marble halls and listen to what the people are saying on occasion.
Or how about walk in the halls and listen to the same people? Because here's what I'll tell you is I'm willing to bet donuts to dollars that your staff are some of those same people because they are so endeared to the institution, not the people. And so they see the tarnished reputation of the institution by the actions of the people that just happen to be there for now. So even if you walk down the marble halls, you got some career
employees that are in those halls that are shaking their heads saying, tis, tis, tis. And this is such a shame because this is not how it used to be.
Years ago, when I had my fellowship at the U.S. Supreme Court, I worked part of the time in the Office of Public Information for the court. Back then, it was a fairly easy task. Justices didn't talk about anything. You issued opinions. There was no question about the opinion. The opinion said what it said, and that was it.
You mean they didn't leak?
Yeah. Now, oh my God, now the poor public information office and public information officer, you know, it's they have to be like an octopus with eight arms trying to handle everything. And you've got a chief going, oh, they don't like us? Oh, why? You know? So, anyway,
they sit with us at the lunch table?
Yeah.
What do you mean they don't believe me when I say things?
Let's move on to the actual sentencing, which occurred on January 10th. And Trump and his attorney appeared virtually in front of Judge Juan Merchan. Now, let's stop right there before we go forward. How many times have you had a criminal defendant before you as a judge or as a prosecutor? How many times have you had a criminal defendant appear virtually on a felony for sentencing?
Never.
Never.
I will just tell you, never. Happen. Felonies are considered more serious offenses, even if there's no mandatory term of incarceration, meaning I'm not mandatorily required to impose prison or jail. If it is a serious offense, even if it's a serious misdemeanor, it's highly unlikely that you'll be permitted to appear virtually.
So there was an accommodation that went beyond what the ordinary felon, convicted felon, would get, right? I mean, it was special treatment.
Indeed. And it's the kind of special treatment that, listen, we cannot deny our listeners the obvious, which is it is special treatment that you, Mr. or Mrs. John Q. Public, will not likely experience if it were you, or if it were your loved one, or if it were your neighbor, or your friend, or your coworker, or boss, or other family member. It is highly, highly, highly unlikely. Again, even if the court is not going to impose a harsh sanction like incarceration. And what's even unlikely, even more unlikely, and you could tell me if you did this, because I know I did not ever, I don't think I ever did this, which is I'm never going to reduce to writing in an order what I am going to sentence the defendant to.
No.
Things would go off the rails all the time at sentencings, and I might have something in mind, and they might walk themselves into jail just by their very words, or it may be anything else. But I mean, in this, there was every benefit provided to defendant Trump that did not and does not normally extend to every other defendant, even wealthier defendants. It just doesn't happen. Look at
all right. Puff Daddy. So one, he got special treatment on that. Two, as in every sentencing, the judge allows the defendant to speak to the court on his or her own. And in this case, Judge Merchan allowed President-elect Trump to speak. And it was the typical. It was the attack on the court. It was attack on the case. It was attack on the prosecution. It wasn't a statement that was endearing. Most of the time as judge, I would listen to people taking accountability for or responsibility for what they did, some kind of feeling of remorse some kind of hope that they would never do this again. You're listening for sort of ticks or indicators.
At least I was.
But here you got absolutely the opposite.
Wasn't it to be expected?
Well, it was, and I think Judge Mershon handled it brilliantly by letting it go and really not taking bait on it or responding to it. But still, I mean, please, you know, it was again something that a normal defendant on a convicted of 34 felonies and facing up to 4 years in prison would not do. You would not have your client do that. You know, you would not have your client attack the court. No.
But remember, we're also talking about the same defendant and attorneys and personalities that have gratuitously attacked the court staff, the court's family, the prosecutors, and everyone throughout the entire process from inception all the way through into sentencing, everything. I mean, this is someone who believed that how a state votes politically would make some impact on what jury outcomes and jury verdicts are, and actually sought, if I remember this, and remind me if I'm wrong, if I remember, there was even an effort earlier in these proceedings to remove the case to like West Virginia because it was determined to be you know, more of a Republican leaning state that would be more favorable.
Change of venue to West Virginia.
Yes. And for no reason other than the fact that yes, the people there tend to vote Republican, and because they do, that necessarily means that they will not find the defendant guilty, which should have told us then that there was a lot of credence to the prosecution's case if you were looking to change the venue because of that. But yeah, I would love to say that this is surprising, but it's not surprising. It's reprehensible to the extent that now what we're talking about is the leader of the free world showing and demonstrating such disdain and disrespect, consistent over and over again, disrespect for the third co-equal branch of government.
And disrespect for the rule of law, period.
Yeah, which will make it all the more difficult for every other judge, no matter who you are, where you are, and you know what you're doing, it will make it hard for you because you have, the leader of the free world who has absolutely not just demonstrated, has verbalized that they have no respect for this branch of government. None.
Well, Judge Mershon, in his normal pacing and quiet manner, basically listened to all that and then told Trump that, look, you know, but for you being elected president, you were going to prison on this. I mean, he basically said that. But the fact that you're elected president, I have as the judge, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, I have as the judge respect for our country and the position of the presidency that I can't do what I would normally do at this sentencing hearing. I thought that was a clear message. Of course, it went right over the head of the defense. But I thought it was a clear message and a way to explain why he was doing what he was doing. And what he did do was grant Trump unconditional discharge. Now, let me just explain that a moment, and then we'll get back to Judge Gale on this. Under New York law, this is a New York state law, a judge can impose, it's the most lenient sentence you can have, an actual sentence of unconditional discharge. Now, it means that there is no sentence, no fine, no probation, no standards of probation that have to be met, no conditions that have to be met. It just means the case is over, you walk free, that's it. But the judge can only issue that if the judge is of the opinion, this is a quote, of the opinion that no proper purpose would be served by imposing any condition upon the defendant's release. So the judge basically said, okay, you got elected president. You're going to be president of all of these United States here on January 20th. I can't impose conditions on you because I respect the office of the presidency. Not I respect you. I respect the office of the presidency. So I'm going to go to this specific aspect of New York law and give you a pass. Is that, do I have it right?
You're absolutely correct. And I know that was to the disappointment of many. Especially after, you know, we certainly talked about all of the options that Judge Mershon has that also included imposing a sentence and suspending it until after the term of the presidency or this presidency had ended. And nonetheless, what he's reminded us of is that it is not deference to the person, it is deference or respect for the office that is monumentally important. And even Prosecutor Bragg's office, as you mentioned before, were not in opposition to this happening, which is why I don't understand why the other side couldn't take yes for an answer. But
the Scarlet Letter.
I believe it's the Scarlet Letter. I believe what their fight is now is just about the Scarlet Letter itself. And certainly can't be about anything else other than the fact that, yes, this is a conviction that sticks and stays, and a conviction that, you know, I would suspect if there's an expungement or record sealing trigger in the law that they would look to take advantage of that. But as it stands now, we as a country are preparing to inaugurate to the highest office in the land. I hope y'all listening, anybody over at Leavenworth, just start your political campaign now because that's your ticket out of there. We're going to inaugurate a convicted felon to the office of the presidency and sit him behind the resolute desk to make some of the most important decisions in our lives as Americans. And this is the will of the people. And so, and meanwhile, interestingly, as we talk about this being his state conviction out of the state of New York, there's talk that as the president of the United States, this man is also toying with the idea of pardoning federally convicted felons who engaged in insurrection, on January 6th. So that's interesting because he can't pardon himself from a state crime. But
well,
let's jump
into that just a bit. Mm-hmm. A president can pardon people from federal crimes. The president has no authority to pardon people for state crimes that have been processed through state courts. The case that we've been talking about is a New York state case, mm-hmm. not a federal case. And so the president has no ability to pardon himself in a state case. There's question whether he can pardon himself, period, but he can't certainly pardon himself in a state case. Only a governor of a state can pardon people on state cases. And the governor being a pretty strong Democrat in New York, I don't think that's within the realm of possibility, at least in the short term.
I think that New York has probably solidified itself as you know, the if again, and if politics plays a role in this, I think New York is really clear to have solidified itself in a blue column, and therefore is highly unlikely to elect a governor that will undo this. And here's also the refreshing thing of this, and we didn't touch on this by comparison, but I just want to note one thing that I think has been really refreshing, whether you like Judge Marchand's decisions or not, whether you agree with them or not, first, they are always well-reasoned. They are extremely thorough. They are deeply researched, and they hold deep fidelity to the law. So I have no issues with the fact that Judge Marchand has taken the steps and the efforts to be so very careful in handling this, one of the highest profile cases he's probably had in his whole career, which is very different from how I have seen Judge Cannon handle herself in the cases in Florida.
The documents cases,
yeah. Which is very disappointing. And realizing that, yes, I am comparing a state judge to a federal judge. At the end of the day, the law still deserves the integrity that is naturally or should be naturally embedded in it. And I really genuinely feel, even for Judge Marchand, who endured insults and wrath and all kinds of chicanery during the case in New York, Judge Cannon endured no such thing and instead at least appeared to still bend to the will of the defendant more than even necessary. What I got from Judge Marchand is that this would be a fair case, that these are the protocols that are going to be respected and acknowledged, and this is how we're going to handle this case. And no, you may not like the process, but this is still the process. So he didn't gag him from going out every day and talking to the pool of cameras and reporters, and that, I mean, where the president-elect would disparage the judge completely. And yet, by comparison, you see Judge Cannon, who I believe, or at least appear to just really be so committed to protecting the defendant, that the defense attorneys had to do very little work of their own. In fact, she went as far as to all but literally lift language and adopt it into an order where it hadn't even been a germane argument for the Supreme Court in the first place, but it was the exact blueprint she needed. And I did not see, and I still don't see, where there's
been any— It was a concurring opinion by Justice Thomas that she lifted,
which should have just started with, who asked you? Okay, who asked you? But Judge Cannon has, again, even I think that goes to Justice Roberts' his point of, oh gosh, we aren't trusted, we aren't believed, why don't they like us? When the actions are so brazen and they're so naked that you cannot walk away with any other expectation or other suspicion that this is just a tool that is being used for the benefit of one side against another, that's not fair. That's also not justice. And I think that's where some of the greatest disservice has come into play and why there's this erosion of trust in the judiciary. Trust erosion is real. I'm glad Justice Roberts is now acknowledging it and seeing it. I just wish that he were more committed to doing something about it, because I don't see that happening.
No, I don't either. And I don't think the court's going to change its complexion in the near future at all. Mm-mm. You know, one of the things that I think that we need to look at here is, I know Trump was president-elect and will be president, but I think he's also in some ways indicative of white-collar criminals. And you and I have been in the trenches and seen the everyday criminal. Mm-hmm. And we've also seen the white-collar criminal. And the white-collar criminal, one, because they can afford better counsel and file more motions, but they also get special privileges in the court. and I think are handled with more kid gloves in courts than the average criminal defendant. I think that we need to get somebody in to talk to us about that and talk to us about the whole idea of white collar crime.
Yes, and how that distinguishes from some of the other more serious crimes that we see in courts. And I absolutely agree. I think we can work on doing that. I think to the benefit of our audience, who, you know, having somebody who maybe specializes in that area and is able to dissect those important details would really, really be helpful. So,
because right now it just seems like a disparity between the two. Now, maybe there are some reasons behind it. I don't know. But right now it just seems grossly unfair for the average person who gets involved in criminal activity.
That's true, but I think it's fair to talk about, and what we've talked about is some of the reasons for the obvious disparity is the fact that the status of the defendant does matter. It matters that the defendant is the president-elect, and even Judge Marchand went as far as to say, if you weren't, then whew,
you're going to jail, bud.
You would have been at Rikers with your good buddy Weisselberg. you know, you guys could have been cellmates and been talking about who's going to put some money on your books.
We just have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to talk about appeal. And now that sentencing is over, now there opens the door to Trump's legal team to file appeals for everything that went on pre-trial, during trial, post-trial to the intermediate level court of appeals in the state of New York. You can't appeal a lot of things involved in your case until the case is concluded. Sentencing concludes the case.
That's
so
right.
Now Trump can start the whole process of appeal again as a potential way to exonerate him and take off the mantle of convicted felon. But it was interesting because Judge Roberts in his decision said, and if we go forward with sentencing, then President Trump, and I'm paraphrasing, can go forward with his appeals. And Trump afterwards said, you know, I disagreed with the Supreme Court decision, but I'm glad they said that I have a right to appeal. They didn't say that you had a right to appeal. They just said that you could go forward with appeal because your case is going to be concluded. But
right,
this is going to open up a whole new avenue of attacks on Judge Marchand and the process.
Oh, absolutely. And but what I will say, which you are absolutely right about, this is when you have, you know, non-law trained lunatics interpreting the law.
Yeah,
I've dealt
Supreme
with a couple
Court
of them.
Gave me a right to appeal. Wow.
Listen, and I've dealt with quite a few non-law trained lunatics who believe that they know how to interpret the law. And unfortunately, some of those hold elected office. And it's just a really sad commentary that those people are in positions of power and authority, such as mayors, who couldn't read anything. They couldn't read a note card if you wrote it out for them in crayon. But that said, it really does speak to now what the strategy is going forward. I think there had always been a strategy to appeal, but you must have what's called a final appealable order. And that order becomes effective unless there's what's called an interlocutory appeal, which are appeals that can be taken up in the middle of a trial because the rulings are so egregious. With this
On the immunity issue.
Or you know, on the immunity issue. Yeah. Exactly. But this is the signaling from Justice Roberts is now with the pronouncement of sentence, the case now becomes or considered fully resolved in New York, such that now there's a final appealable order where everything preceding up to and including the sentencing can now be appealed. It doesn't mean you got a, you know, automatic right to it. It doesn't even mean that you have legitimate grounds for it. What it means is that there has to be a natural endpoint to the proceedings that then allows or provides for that jurisdictional transfer to the appeals court, whether it's the U.S. Supreme Court or it's any other intermediate appeals court, for those courts to actually consider it. The final thing I'll say is consider the fact, Judge, that there is the smallest percentage of cases that ever get heard by the United States Court of Appeals, U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, just they have to vote on which cases are granted what's called certiorari. And again, that number is so small. I, in part, kind of see this as an abuse of standing in society or positioning to essentially leapfrog over every other intermediate appellate court and to constantly go straight back to the U.S. Supreme Court, because for every case they take of President-elect Trump's, no matter how much it may be lacking in merit, you better know that that's one less case where substantive law can be reviewed or decided in another more important case that can affect all of us. All of us aren't really going to be as affected by these Trump decisions. Right. But when there are cases that are actually appealed through the process to the United States Supreme Court, every time one of these rocket docket cases makes its way over to the U.S. Supreme Court, then in my view, that then limits the ability of other more important and matters that are more germane. It limits their ability to be heard, reviewed, and decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. And I think that, too, is such a miscarriage of justice to everyone else in the country who relies on this court to make decisions affecting their lives.
And with that, we're going to wrap it up today, and hopefully we won't have to talk about President Trump's legal process or legal procedures in the near future. But
I hope you're not holding your breath.
Hold on, because he gets inaugurated here, and we'll see what happens between him and his new cabinet members and administration. We may be back on topic here very, very soon. Until then, Judge, how do people find us, and what do we want them to do with us?
Oh my gosh, we are so excited that our audience is growing and that you all are continuing to support us through this podcast. And so we want you to continue to do so. Check out Next Witness, Please, anywhere you get your favorite podcast, starting with our most favored and endeared partner, that being NPR, National Public Radio. You can check us out there, but you can also find us on every other major podcast platform, including Apple, Spotify, Amazon, again, or anywhere else you find your favorite podcast. We will ask that when you check us out to please not just listen, but make sure you review us and you rate us. It is important that we know what you're thinking and what information we can bring to you to kind of help to enlighten you, especially about processes that take place in the courtroom.
And if you have any questions or comments about our podcast, you can email it to me. You can email it at hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu. And also, if you have topics you want us to cover, shoot us an email and we'll add your topic to our upcoming episode list. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gail and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.